Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm your host, Robert Houghton, and tonight we have part two of H.G. Wells' of the New World Order. Tonight is Thursday, May 27th, 2004. We'll try to continue this series next week and finish it up so that any of you that are interested in getting a copy of it can obtain it. Just going to give out our website address, which is hourofthetime.com. You may write to us by snail mail at HOTT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelt E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Once again, our website is hourofthetime.com, and you can go there and check out many of the new products that we have for sale, including a couple of videos that have never been released before. We have a new videotape from Bill coming out probably this, well, it won't be this week now, it'll be next week. So that'll be three new tapes in the last couple of weeks. So if you're interested in checking any of those out, please go to the website and check there every couple of days. We do update the page every day when possible, but the new videos will be there as soon as they're available. So that there's two. Assassin Unmasked, and Behold the Pale Horse videos presently on sale, and the new one will be coming shortly. And we'd like to thank Kathy for sending us the original tape for that one, something we had not had before. It's a local cable access show where Bill was interviewed. I believe it's about 58 minutes long, excellent quality. It's obviously a copy directly from the studio or something like that. Very interesting piece. I haven't actually seen the whole thing yet. Doyle has been doing some editing on it, and it should be available shortly. So, to continue with the program, H.G. Wells, The New World Order. This book was written in 1940. We have gone through the first two chapters of it, and I believe we are on chapter four right now. So we're going to continue with his discussion of Marxism in this chapter. And so here they are, hammer and sickle in hand, chest stuck out, proud, magnificent, commanding in the manifesto. But go and look at them for yourself in the streets. Go and look at them in Russia. Even for 1848, this is not intelligent social analysis. It is the outpouring of a man with a bee in his bonnet, the hated bourgeoisie, a man with certain vision, uncritical of his own subconscious prejudices, but shrewd enough to realize how great a driving force are hate and the inferiority complex. Shrewd enough to use hate and bitter enough to use hate. Let anyone read over that Communist Manifesto and consider who might have shared the hate or even have got it all if Marx had not been the son of a rabbi. Read Jews for Bourgeoisie, and the manifesto is pure Nazi teaching of the 1933 to 1938 vintage. Stripped down to its core in this fashion, the primary falsity of the Marxist assumption is evident, but it is one of the queer common weaknesses of the human mind to be uncritical of primary assumptions and to smother up any inquiry into their soundness and secondary elaboration in technicalities and conventional formulas. Most of our systems of belief rest upon rotten foundations, and generally these foundations are made sacred to preserve them from attack. They become dogmas in a sort of holy of holies. It is shockingly uncivil to say, but that is nonsense. The defenders of all the dogmatic religions fly into rage and indignation when one touches on the absurdity of their foundations, especially if one laughs. That is blasphemy. The avoidance of fundamental criticism is one of the greatest dangers to any general human understanding. Marxism is no exception to the universal tendency. The capitalist system has to be a real system. The bourgeoisie, an organized conspiracy against the workers, and every human conflict everywhere has to be an aspect of the class war, or they cannot talk to you. They will not listen to you. Never once has there been an attempt to answer the plain things I have been saying about them for a third of a century. Anything not in their language flows off their minds like water off a duck's back. Even Lenin, by far the subtlest mind in the communist story, has not escaped this pitfall, and when I talked to him in Moscow in 1920, he seemed quite unable to realize that the violent conflict going on in Ireland between the Catholic nationalists and the Protestant garrison was not his sacred insurrection of the proletariat in full blast. Today there is quite a number of writers, and among them there are men of science who ought to think better, solemnly elaborating a pseudo-philosophy of science and society upon the deeply buried but entirely nonsensical foundations laid by Marx. Month by month, the industrious Left Book Club pours a new volume over the minds of its devotees to sustain their mental habits and pickle them against the septic influence of unorthodox literature. A party index of forbidden books will no doubt follow. Distinguished professors, with a solemn delight in their own remarkable ingenuity, lecture and discourse and even produce serious-looking volumes upon the superiority of Marxist physics and Marxist research to the unbranded activities of the human mind. One tries not to be rude to them, but it is hard to believe what they are not deliberately playing the fool with their brains. Or have they a feeling that revolutionary communism is ahead, and are they doing their best to rationalize it with an eye to those red days to come? Here I cannot pursue in any detail the story of the rise and corruption of Marxism in Russia. It confirms in every particular my contention that the class war idea is an entanglement and perversion of the world drive towards a world collectivism, a wasting disease of cosmopolitan socialism. It has followed in this general outline the common history of every revolt of the have-nots since history began. Russia in the shadows displayed an immense inefficiency and sank slowly to Russia in the dark. Its galaxy of incompetent foremen, managers, organizers, and so forth developed the most complicated system of self-protection against criticism. They sabotaged one another. They intrigued against one another. You can read the quintessence of the thing in little pages In Search of Soviet Gold. And as in every other have-not revolt since the dawn of history, hero worship took possession of the insurgent masses. The inevitable champion arrived. The escape from the Tsar, and in 20 years they are worshipping Stalin. Originally a fairly honest, unoriginal, ambitious revolutionary, driven to self-defensive cruelty, and inflated by flattery to his present quasi-divine autocracy. The cycle completes itself, and we see that, as in every other merely insurrectionary revolution, nothing has changed. A lot of people have been liquidated, and a lot of other people have replaced them, and Russia seems returning back to a point at which it started, to a patriotic absolutism of doubtful efficiency and vague, incalculable aims. Stalin, I believe, is honest and benevolent in intention. He believes in collectivism simply and plainly. He is still under the impression that he is making a good thing of Russia and of the countries within her sphere of influence, and he is self-righteously impatient of criticism or opposition. His successor may not have the same disinterestedness. That one didn't roll off the tongue very well, did it? But I have written enough to make it clear why we have to dissociate collectivization altogether from the class war in our minds. Let us waste no more time on the spectacle of Marxist putting the cart in front of the horse and tying himself up with the harness. We have to put all this proletarian distortion of the case out of our minds and start afresh upon the problem of how to realize the new and unprecedented possibilities of world collectivization that have opened up upon the world in the past 100 years. That is a new story, an entirely different story. We human beings are facing gigantic forces that will either destroy our species altogether or lift it to an altogether unprecedented level of power and well-being. These forces have to be controlled or we shall be annihilated. But, competently controlled, they can abolish toil, they can abolish poverty, they can abolish slavery, by the one sure means of making these things unnecessary. Class war communism has had its opportunity to realize all this, and it has failed to make good. So far, it has only replaced one autocratic Russia by another. Russia, like all the rest of the world, is still facing the problem of competent government of a collective system. She has not solved it. The dictatorship of the proletariat has failed us. We have to look for possibilities of control in other directions. Are they to be found? And here's a note at the end of this chapter, ladies and gentlemen. A friendly advisor reading the passages on page 32 protests against the wombs of associated labor as a mistranslation of the original German of the manifesto. I took it from the translation of Professor Hirandareth Mukherjee in an Indian student's journal, Sirasha, which happened to be on my desk. But my advisor produces Lily G. Aitken and Frank C. Budgeon in a Glasgow Socialist Labour Press publication who give it as the lap of social labour, which is more refrained but pure nonsense. The German word is Schoss, and in its widest sense it means the whole productive maternal outfit from bosom to knees, and here, quite definitely, the womb. The French translation gives sign, which at first glance seems to carry gentility to an even higher level. But as you can say in French that an expectant mother carries her child in her sign, I think Professor Mukherjee has it. Thousands of reverent young communists must have read that lap without observing its absurdity. Marx is trying to make out of the increase of productive efficiency was due to association in factories. A better phrase to express his wrong-headed intention would have been the coordinated operations of workers massed in factories. I'm going to continue now reading from H.G. Wells' The New World Order, published in 1940, Chapter 5, Unsated Youth. We have now to examine these disruptive forces a little more closely. These disruptive forces which are manifestly overstraining and destroying the social and political system in which most of us have been reared. At what particular points in our political and social life are these disruptive forces discovering breaking points? Chief among these breaking points, people are beginning to realize more and more clearly, is the common, half-educated young man. One particular consequence of this onrush of power and invention in our time is the release of a great flood of human energy in the form of unemployed young people. This is a primary factor of the general political instability. We have to recognize that humanity is not suffering, as most animal species, when they suffer, seem to do, from hunger or want in any material form. It is threatened not by deficiency, but by excess. It is plethoric. It is not lying down to die through physical exhaustion. It is knocking itself to pieces. Measured by any standards except human contentment and ultimate security, mankind appears to be much wealthier now than in 1918. The quantities of power and material immediately available are much greater. What is called productivity is greater in general. But there is sound reason for supposing that a large part of this increased productivity is really a swifter and more thorough exploitation of irreplaceable capital. It is a process that cannot go on indefinitely. It rises to a maximum, and then the feast is over. Natural resources are being exhausted at a great rate, and the increased output goes into war munitions whose purpose is destruction, and into sterile indulgences no better than waste. Man, heir of the ages, is a demoralized spendthrift in a state of galloping consumption, living on stimulants. When we look into the statistics of population, there is irrefutable proof that everywhere we are passing a maximum. See for this Enid Charles' The Twilight of Parenthood, or R.R. Kuczynski's Measurement of Population Growth. And that a rapid decline is certain not only in Western Europe, but throughout the world. There is sound reason for doubting the alleged vast increase of the Russian people, see Suvarin's Stalin. Nevertheless, because of the continually increasing efficiency of productive methods, the relative pressure of these new unemployed classes increases. The mob of the 20th century is quite different from the almost animal mob of the 18th century. It is a restless sea of dissatisfied young people of young women who no longer bear children and young men who can find no outlet for their natural urgencies and ambitions. Young people quite ready to make trouble as soon as they are shown how. In the technically crude past, the illiterate have-nots were sweated and overworked. It was easy to find toil and to keep them all busy. Such surplus multitudes are wanted no more. Toil is no longer marketable. Machines can toil better and with less resistance. These frustrated multitudes have been made acutely aware of their own frustration. The gap of their always partly artificial disadvantage has been greatly diminished because they now all read. Even for incidental employment, it has been necessary to teach them that, and the new reading public thus created has evoked a press and literature of excitement and suggestion. The cinema and radio dazzle them with spectacles of luxury and unrestricted living. They are not the helpless Hodges and factory fodder of 100 years ago. They are educated up to what must have been the middle class level in 1889. They are indeed largely a squeezed out middle class, restless, impatient, and as we shall see, extremely dangerous. They have assimilated almost all of the lower strata that were formerly illiterate drudges. And this modernized excess population has no longer any social humility. It has no belief in the infallible wisdom of its rulers. It sees them too clearly. It knows about them, their wastes, their vices and weaknesses, with an even exaggerated vividness. It sees no reason for its exclusion from the good things of life by such people. It has long lost enough of its inferiority to realize that most of that inferiority is arbitrary and artificial. You may say that this is a temporary state of affairs, that the fall in population will presently relieve the situation by getting rid of this surplus of the not wanted. But it will do nothing of the sort. As population falls, consumption will fall. Industries will still be producing more and more efficiently for a shrinking market, and they will be employing fewer and fewer hands. A state of 5 million people with 500,000 of useless hands will be twice as unstable as 40 million with 2 million standing off. So long as the present state of affairs continues, this stratum of perplexed young people, out of it, will increase relatively to the total community. It is still not realized as clearly as it should be how much the troubles of the present time are due to this new aspect of the social puzzle. But if you will scrutinize the events of the past half century in the light of this idea, you will see more and more convincingly that it is mainly through this growing mass of unfulfilled desire that the disruptive forces manifest themselves. The eager and adventurous unemployed, young, are indeed the shock troops in the destruction of the old social order everywhere. They find guidance in some confident party or some inspired champion who organizes them for revolutionary or counter-revolutionary ends. It scarcely matters which. They become communists or they become fascists, Nazis, the Irish Republican Army, Ku Klux Klansmen, and so forth and so on. The essence is the combination of energy, frustration, and discontent. What all such movements have in common is a genuine indignation at the social institutions that have begotten and then cold-shouldered them, a quasi-military organization, and the resolve to seize power for themselves embodied in their leaders. A wise and powerful government would at any cost anticipate and avert these destructive activities by providing various and interesting new employment and the necessary condition for a satisfying, successful life for everyone. These young people are life. The rise of the successful leader only puts off the trouble for a time. He seizes power in the name of his movement. And then, when the seizure of power has been effected, he finds himself obliged to keep things going, to create justification for his leadership, exciting enterprises, urgencies. A leader of vision with adequate technical assistance might conceivably direct much of the human energy he has embodied into creative channels. For example, he could rebuild the dirty, inadequate cities of our age, turn the still slovenly countryside into a garden and playground, reclothe, liberate, and stimulate imaginations until the ideas of creative progress become a habit of mind. But in doing this, he will find himself confronted by those who are sustained by the preemptions and appropriations of the old order. These relatively well-off people will bargain with him up to the last moment for their money and impede his seizure and utilization of the land and material resources. And he will be further hampered by the fact that in organizing his young people, he has to turn their minds and capacities from creative work to systematic violence and militant activities. It is easy to make an unemployed young man into a fascist or gangster, but it is hard to turn him back to any decent social task. Moreover, the champion's own leadership was largely due to his conspiratorial and adventurous quality. He is himself unfit for a creative job. He finds himself a fighter at the head of a fighting pack. And furthermore, unless his country is on the scale of Russia and the United States, whatever he attempts in order to make good his promises of an abundant life has to be done in face of that mutual pressure of the sovereign states due to the abolition of distance and change of scale which we have already considered. He has no elbow room in which to operate. The resultant of these convergent difficulties is to turn him and his fighting pack relentlessly towards the simplifying, liberating, and releasing flux of predatory war. Everywhere in the world, under varying local circumstances, we see governments primarily concerned with this supreme problem of what to do with these young adults who are unemployable under present conditions. We have to realize that and bear it constantly in mind. It is there in every country. It is the most dangerous and wrong-headed view of the world situation to treat the totalitarian countries as differing fundamentally from the rest of the world. The problem of reabsorbing the unemployable adult is the essential problem in all states. It is the common shape to which all current political dramas reduce. How are we to use up or slake this surplus of human energy? The young are the live core of our species. The generation below 16 or 17 has not begun yet to give trouble, and after 40, the ebb of vitality disposes men to accept the lot that has fallen to them. Franklin Roosevelt and Stalin find themselves in control of vast countries underdeveloped or so misdeveloped that their main energies go into internal organization or reorganization. They do not press against their frontiers, therefore, and they do not threaten war. The recent Russian annexations have been precautionary defensive, but all the same, both Russia and America have to cater for that troublesome social stratum quite as much as Europe. The New Deal is plainly an attempt to achieve a working socialism and avert a social collapse in America. It is extraordinarily parallel to the successful policies and plans of the Russian experiment. Rather, it should say it is extraordinarily parallel to the successive policies and plans of the Russian experiment. Americans shirk the word socialism, but what else can one call it? The British oligarchy, demoralized and slack with the accumulated wealth of a century of advantage, bought off social upheaval for a time by the deliberate and socially demoralizing appeasement of the dole. It has made no adequate effort to employ or educate these surplus people. It has just pushed the dole at them. It even tries to buy off the leader of the Labour Party with a salary of £2,000 a year. Whatever we may think of the quality and deeds of the Nazi or fascist regimes or the follies of their leaders, we must at any rate concede that they attempt, however clumsily, to reconstruct life in a collectivist direction. They are efforts to adjust and construct, and so far they are in advance of the British ruling class. The British Empire has shown itself the least constructive of all governing networks. It produces no new deals, no five-year plans. It keeps on trying to stave off its inevitable dissolution and carry on the old lines. Apparently it will do that until it has nothing more to give away. Peace in our time, that foolishly premature self-congratulation of Mr. Chamberlain, is manifestly the guiding principle of the British elder statesman. It is that natural desire we all begin to feel after 60 to sit down comfortably somewhere. Unprogressive tranquility they want at any price, even at the price of a preventive war. This astonishing bunch of rulers has never revealed any conception whatever of a common future before its sprawling empire. There was a time when that empire seemed likely to become the nexus of a world system, but now manifestly it has no future but disintegration. Apparently its rulers expected it to just go on as it was forever. Bit by bit, its component parts have dropped away and become quasi-independent powers, generally after an unedifying struggle. Southern Ireland, for example, is neutral in the present war. South Africa hesitated. Now, and this is why this book is being written, these people, by a string of almost incredible blunders, have entangled what is left of their empire in a great war to, quote, end Hitler. And they have absolutely no suggestion to offer their antagonists and the world at large of what is to come after Hitler. Apparently they hope to paralyze Germany in some as yet unspecified fashion, and then go back to their golf links or the fishing stream and doze by the fire after dinner. That is surely one of the most astounding things in history, the possibility of death and destruction beyond all reckoning, and our combatant governments have no idea of what is to follow when the overthrow of Hitler is accomplished. They seem to be as void of any sense of the future, as completely empty-headed about the aftermath of their campaigns, as one of those American Tories who are, quote, just out against FDR, damn him, unquote. So the British Empire remains, paying its way down to ultimate bankruptcy, buying itself a respite from the perplexing problems of the future with the accumulated wealth and power of its past. It is rapidly becoming the most backward political organization in the world. But sooner or later it will have no more money for the dole, and no more allies to abandon, nor dominions to yield up to their local bosses. And then, possibly, its disintegration will be complete. R.I.P. Leaving intelligent English people to line up at last with America and the rest of the intelligent world and face the universal problem. Which is, how are we to adapt ourselves to these mighty disruptive forces that are shattering human society as it is at present constituted? In the compressed countries which have little internal scope and lack the vast natural resources of the Russian and Atlantic communities, the internal tension makes more directly for aggressive warfare, but the fundamental driving force behind their aggressiveness is still the universal trouble, that surplus of young men. Seen in the broader vision, this present war falls into its true proportions as a stupid conflict upon secondary issues, which is delaying and preventing an overdue world adjustment. That it may kill hundreds of thousands of people does not alter that. An idiot with a revolver can murder a family. He remains an idiot. From 1914 to 1939 has been a quarter of century of folly, meanness, evasion, and resentment, and only a very tedious and copious historian would attempt to distribute the blame among those who had played a part in the story. And when he had done it, what he had done would not matter in the least. An almost overwhelmingly difficult problem has confronted us all, and in some measure we have all of us lost our heads in the face of it, lost our dignity, been too clever by half, pinned ourselves to cheap solutions, quarreled stupidly among ourselves. We have erred and strayed. We have left undone those things that we ought to have done, and we have done those things which we ought not to have done, and there is no health in us. I do not see any way to a solution of the problem of world peace unless we begin with a confession of universal wrong thinking and wrong doing. Then we can sit down to the question of a solution with some reasonable prospect of finding an answer. Now, let us assume that we are a number of intelligent men, German, French, English, American, Italian, Chinese, and so forth, who have decided in consequence of the war and in spite of the war, while the war is still going on, to wipe out all these squabbling bygones from our minds and discuss plainly and simply the present situation of mankind. What is to be done with the world? Let us recapitulate the considerations that so far have been brought into the case and then examine where they lead us, what other general considerations can be brought in, and what prospects they open, if any, of some hopeful concerted action. Action that would so revolutionize the human outlook as to end war and that hectic, recurrent waste of human life and happiness forever. Firstly, then, it has been made apparent that humanity is at the end of an age of fragmentation in the management of its affairs. Fragmentation politically among separate sovereign states, and economically among unrestricted business organizations competing for profit. The abolition of distance, the enormous increase of available power, root causes of all our troubles, have suddenly made what was once a tolerable working system, a system that was perhaps with all its inequalities and injustices, the only practicable working system in its time, rendered it enormously dangerous and wasteful so that it threatens to exhaust and destroy our world altogether. Man is like a feckless heir who has suddenly been able to get at his capital and spend it as though it were income. We are living in a phase of violent and irreparable expenditure. There is an intensified scramble among nations and among individuals to acquire, monopolize, and spend. The dispossessed young find themselves hopeless unless they resort to violence. They implement the ever-increasing instability. Only a comprehensive collectivization of human affairs can arrest this disorderly self-destruction of mankind. All this is made plain in what has gone before. The essential problem, the problem of collectivization, can be viewed from two reciprocal points of view and stated in two different ways. We can ask, what is to be done to end the world chaos? And also, how can we offer the common young man a reasonable and stimulating prospect of a full life? These two questions are the obverse and reverse of one question. What answers one answers the other. The answer to both is that we have to collectivize the world as one system with practically everyone playing a reasonably satisfying part in it. For sound practical reasons, over and above any ethical or sentimental considerations, we have to devise a collectivization that neither degrades nor enslaves. Our imaginary world conference, then, has to turn itself to the question of how to collectivize the world, so that it will remain collectivized and yet enterprising, interesting, and happy enough to content that common young man who will otherwise reappear baffled and sullen at the street corners and throw it into confusion again. To that problem, the rest of this book will address itself. As a matter of fact, it is very obvious that at present time a sort of collectivization is being imposed very rapidly upon the world. Everyone is being enrolled, ordered about, put under control somewhere, even if it is only in an evacuation or concentration camp or whatnot. This process of collectivization of some sort, seems now to be in the nature of things, and there is no reason to suppose it is reversible. Some people imagine world peace at the end of that process. Collectivization is going to be defeated, and a vaguely conceived reign of law will restore and sustain property, Christianity, individualism, and everything to which the respectable prosperous are accustomed. This is implicit even in the title of such a book as Edward Moseley's Man or Leviathan. It is much more reasonable to think that world peace has to be the necessary completion of that process, and that the alternative is a decadent anarchy. If so, the phrase for the aims of liberal thought should not be man or leviathan, but man masters leviathan. On this point, the inevitability of collectivization as the sole alternative to universal brigandage and social collapse, our world conference must make itself perfectly clear. Then it has to turn itself to the much more difficult and complicated question of how. I'd like to remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that you're listening to The Hour of the Time on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 MHz. We are also rebroadcast daily on Radio New York International. You can go to Radio New York International at www.radionewyorkinternational.com. We are broadcast there from 1 p.m. till 2 p.m. every day of the week, Monday through Thursdays on WBCQ, 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tonight's program is H.G. Wells' The New World Order, Part 2. We've now reached Chapter 6, Socialism Unavoidable. Let's continue. Let us, even at the cost of a certain repetition, look a little more closely now into the fashion in which the disruptive forces are manifesting themselves in the Western and Eastern hemispheres. In the Old World, the hypertrophy of armies is the most conspicuous. In America, it was the hypertrophy of big business. But in both, the necessity for an increasing collective restraint upon uncoordinated, overpowerful businesses or political enterprise is more and more clearly recognized. There's a strong opposition on the part of the great interest in America to the president, who has made himself the spearhead of the collectivizing drive. They want to put the brakes now on his progressive socialization of the nation, and quite possibly at the cost of increasing social friction, they may slow down the drift to socialism very considerably. But it is unbelievable that they dare provoke the social convulsion that would ensue upon a deliberate reversal of the engines or upon any attempt to return to the glorious days of big business, wild speculation, and mounting unemployment before 1927. They will merely slow down the drive, for in the world now, all roads lead to socialism or social dissolution. The tempo of the process is different in the two continents. That is the main difference between them. It is not an opposition. They travel at different rates, but they travel towards an identical goal. In the Old World at present, the socialization of the community is going on far more rapidly and thoroughly than it is in America because of the perpetual war threat. In Western Europe now, the dissolution and the drive towards socialization progress by leaps and bounds. The British governing class, and the British politicians generally, overtaken by a war they had not the intelligence to avert, have tried to atone for their slovenly unimaginativeness during the past 20 years in a passion of witless improvisation. God knows what their actual war preparations amount to, but their domestic policy seems to be based on an imperfect study of Barcelona, Guernica, Madrid, and Warsaw. They imagine similar catastrophes on a larger scale, although they are quite impossible, as every steady-headed person who can estimate the available supplies of petrol knows, and they have a terrible dread of being held responsible. They fear a day of reckoning with their long-bamboozled lower classes. In their panic, they are rapidly breaking up the existing order altogether. The changes that have occurred in Great Britain in less than a year are astounding. They recall in many particulars the social dislocation of Russia in the closing months of 1917. There has been a shifting and mixing up of people that would have seemed impossible to anyone in 1937. The evacuation of the centers of population under the mere exaggerated threat of air raids has been carried out by the authorities in a mood of frantic recklessness. Hundreds of thousands of families have been broken up, children separated from their parents and quartered in homes of more or less reluctant hosts. Parasites and skin diseases, vicious habits and insanitary practices have been spread, as if in a passion of egalitarian propaganda, from the slums of such centers as Glasgow, London, and Liverpool, through the length and breadth of the land. Railways, road traffic, all the normal communications have been dislocated by a universal running about. For a couple of months, Great Britain has been more like a disturbed anthill than an organized, civilized country. The contagion of funk has affected everyone. Public institutions and great business concerns have bolted to remote and inconvenient sites. The BBC organization, for example, scuffled off headlong from London, needlessly and ridiculously, no man pursuing it. There has been a wild epidemic of dismissals of servants employed in London, for example, and a still wilder shifting of unsuitable men to novel, unnecessary jobs. Everyone has been exhorted to serve the country. Children of 12, to the great delight of conservative-minded farmers, have been withdrawn from school and put to work on the land. And yet the number of those who have lost their jobs and cannot find anything else to do have gone up by over 100,000. There have been amateurish attempts to ration food, producing waste here and artificial scarcity there. A sort of massacre of small independent businesses is in progress, mainly due to the advantage of the big provision dealing concerns, who changed in a night from open profiteers to become the expert advisors of food supply. All the expertise they have ever displayed has been the extraction of profits from food supply. But while profits mount, taxation, with an air of great resolution, sets itself to prune them. The British public has always been phlegmatic in the face of danger, and it is too stout-hearted and too stupid to give way to excesses of fear. But the authorities have thought it necessary to plaster the walls with vast, manifestly expensive posters, headed with a royal crown: "Your courage, your resolution, your cheerfulness will bring us victory." "Oh, yes," says the London Cockney, "you'll get my victory all right, trust you. On my courage, my resolution, my cheerfulness, you'll use up Tommy Atkins all right, larf at him in a kindly sort of way and use him, and then you'll think twice, you'll put him back in on the dust heap, again, twice." This is all too credible. By this time our rulers were emerged discredited and frustrated from the conflict to face a disorganized population in a state of mutinous inquiry. They have made preposterous promises to restore Poland, and that they will certainly have to eat their words about that. Or, what is more probable, the government will have to give place to another administration which will be able to eat those words for them with a slightly better grace. There is little prospect of Thanksgiving services or any armistice night orgy this time. People at home are tasting the hardships of war even more tediously and irritatingly than the men on active service. Cinemas, theaters have been shut prematurely, blackouts have diminished the safety of the streets and doubled the tale of road casualties. The British crowd is already a sullen crowd. The world has not seen it in such a bad temper for a century and a half, and, let there be no mistake about it, it is far less in a temper with the Germans than it is with its own rulers. Through all this swirling intimidating propaganda of civil disorder and a systematic suppression of news and criticism of the most exasperating sort, war preparation has proceeded. The perplexed and baffled citizen can only hope that on the military side there has been a little more foresight and less hysteria. The loss of confidence, and particularly confidence in the government and social order, is already enormous. No one feels secure in his job, in his services, in his savings any longer. People lose confidence even in the money in their pockets, and human society is built on confidence. It cannot carry on without it. Things are like this already, and it is only the opening stage of this strange war. The position of the ruling class and the financial people who have hitherto dominated British affairs is a peculiar one. The cost of the war is already enormous, and there is no sign that it will diminish. Income tax, super tax, death duties, taxes on war profits have been raised to a level that should practically extinguish the once prosperous middle strata of society altogether. The very wealthy will survive in a shorn and diminished state. They will hang on to the last, but the graded classes that have hitherto intervened between them and the impoverished masses of the population, who will be irritated by war sacrifices, extensively unemployed, and asking more and more penetrating questions, will have diminished greatly. Only by the most ingenious monetary manipulation, by dangerous tax dodging and expedients verging on sheer scoundrelism, will a clever young man have the ghost of a chance of climbing by the old traditional money-making ladder above his fellows. On the other hand, the career of a public employee will become continually more attractive. There is more interest in it and more self-respect. The longer the war continues, the completer and more plainly irreparable will be the dissolution of the old order. Now, to many readers who have been incredulous of the statement of the first section of this book, that we are living in the end of an age, To those who have been impervious to the account of the disruptive forces that are breaking up the social order, and to the argument I have drawn from them, who may have got away from all that, so to speak, by saying they are scientific, or materialistic, or sociological, or highbrow, or that providence that has hitherto displayed such a marked bias in favor of well-off, comfortable, sluggish-minded people, is sure to do something nice for them at the 11th hour. The real inconveniences, alarms, losses, and growing disorder of the life about them may at last bring a realization that the situation in Western Europe is approaching revolutionary conditions. It will be a hard saying for many people in the advantage-holding classes, and particularly if they are middle-aged, that the old order has already gone to pieces and can never be put back. But how can they doubt that? A revolution, that is to say a more or less convulsive effort at social and political readjustment, is bound to come in all these overstrained countries, in Germany, in Britain, and universally. It is more likely than not to arise directly out of the exasperating diminuendos and crescendos of the present war as a culminating phase of it. Revolution of some sort we must have. We cannot prevent its onset, but we can affect the course of its development. It may end in utter disaster, or it may release a new world, far better than the old. Within these broad limits, it is possible for us to make up our minds how it will come to us. And since the only practical question before us is the question of how we will take this world revolution we cannot possibly evade, let me recall to your attention the reasons I have advanced in Chapter 2 of this book for the utmost public discussion of our situation at the present time. And also let me bring back to mind the examination of Marxism in Chapter 4. There it is shown how easily a collectivist movement, especially when it is faced by the forcibly feeble resistances and suppressions of those who have hitherto enjoyed wealth and power, may degenerate into an old-fashioned clash war, become conspiratorial, dogmatic, and inadaptable, and sink towards leader worship and autocracy. That, apparently, is what has happened in Russia in its present phase. We do not know how much of the original revolutionary spirit survives there, and a real fundamental issue in the world situation is whether we are going to follow in the footsteps of Russia, or whether we are going to pull ourselves together, face the stern logic of necessity, and produce a Western revolution, which will benefit by Russian experience, react upon Russia, and lead ultimately to a world understanding. What is it that the Atlantic world finds most objectionable in the Soviet world of today? Is there any disapproval of collectivism as such? Only in the case of a dwindling minority of rich and successful men, and very rarely the sons of such people. Very few capable men under 50 nowadays remain individualists in political and social matters. They are not even fundamentally anti-communist, only it happens that for various reasons the political life of the community is still in the hands of unteachable, old-fashioned people. What are called democracies suffer greatly from the rule of old men who have not kept pace with the times. The real and effective disapproval, distrust, and disbelief in the soundness of the Soviet system lie not in the out-of-date individualism of these elderly types, but in the conviction that it can never achieve efficiency or even maintain its honest ideal of each for all and all for each, unless it has free speech and an insistence upon legally defined freedoms for the individual within the collectivist framework. We do not deplore the Russian Revolution as a revolution. We complain that it is not a good enough revolution and we want a better one. The more highly things are collectivized, the more necessary is a legal system embodying the rights of man. This has been forgotten under the Soviets, and so men go in fear there of an arbitrary police action. But the more functions your government controls, the more need there is for protective law. The objection to Soviet collectivism is that, lacking the antiseptic of legally assured personal freedom, it will not keep. It professes to be fundamentally a common economic system based upon class war ideas. The industrial director is under the heel of the party Commissar. The political police have gotten altogether out of hand, and affairs gravitate inevitably towards an oligarchy or autocracy protecting its incapacity by the repression of adverse comment. But these valid criticisms merely indicate the sort of collectivization that has to be avoided. It does not dispose of collectivism as such. If we in our turn do not wish to be submerged by the wave of Bolshevization that is evidently advancing from the East, we must implement all these valid objections and create a collectivization that will be more efficient, more prosperous, tolerant, free, and rapidly progressive than the system we condemn. We, who do not like the Stalinized Marxist state, have, as they used to say in British politics, to dish it by going one better. We have to confront Eastern-spirited collectivism with Western-spirited collectivism. Perhaps this may be better put. We may be giving way to a subconscious conceit here and assuming that the West is always going to be thinking more freely and clearly and working more efficiently than the East. It is like that now, but it may not always be like that. Every country has had its phases of illumination and its phases of blindness. Stalin and Stalinism are neither the beginning nor the end of the collectivization of Russia. We are dealing with something still almost impossible to estimate, the extent to which the new Russian patriotism and the new Stalin worship have effaced, and how far they have merely masked the genuine creative international communism of the revolutionary years. The Russian mind is not yet a docile mind, and most of the literature available for a young man to read in Russia, we must remember, is still revolutionary. There has been no burning of the books there. The Moscow radio talks for internal consumption since the Hitler-Stalin understanding betray a great solicitude on the part of the government to make it clear that there has been no sacrifice of the revolutionary principle. That witness to the vitality of public opinion is Russia. The clash between the teachings of the 1920 and 1940s may have a liberating effect on many people's minds. Russians love to talk about ideas. Under the Tsar they talked. It is incredible that they do not talk under Stalin. That question, whether collectivization is to be westernized or easternized, using these words under the caveat of the previous paragraph, is really the first issue before the world today. We need a fully ventilated revolution. Our revolution has to go on in the light and air. We may have to accept Sovietization a la Russe quite soon unless we can produce a better collectivization. But if we produce a better collectivization, it is more probable that not the Russian system will incorporate our improvements, forgetting it, its reviving nationalism again, debunk Marx and Stalin, so far as they can be debunked, and merge into the one world state. Between these primary antagonists, between revolution with its eyes open and revolution with a mask and a gag, there will certainly be complications of the issue due to patriotism and bigotry, and the un- unteachable willful blindness of those who do not want to see. Most people lie a lot to themselves before they lie to other people, and it is hopeless to expect that all the warring cults and traditions that confuse the mind of the race today are going to fuse under a realization of the imperative nature of the human situation as I have stated it here. Multitudes will never realize it. Few human beings are able to change their primary ideas after the middle 30s. They get fixed in them and drive before them no more intelligently than animals drive before their innate impulses. They will die rather than change their second selves. One of the most entangling of these disconcerting secondary issues is that created by the stupid and persistent intrigues of the Roman Catholic Church. Let me be clear here. I am speaking of the Vatican and of its sustained attempts to exercise a directive role in secular life. I number among my friends many Roman Catholics who have built the most charming personalities and behavior systems on the framework provided them by their faith. One of the loveliest characters I have ever known was G.K. Chesterton, but I think he was just as fine before he became a Catholic as afterwards. Still, he found something he needed in Catholicism. There are saints of all creeds and of none, so good are the possibilities of human nature. Religious observances provide a frame that many find an indispensable, for the seemly order of their lives. And outside the ranks of strict observers, many good people with hardly more theology than a Unitarian love to speak of goodness and kindness as Christianity. So-and-so is a good Christian. Voltaire, says Alfred Noyes, the Catholic writer, was a good Christian. I do not use the word Christianity in that sense, because I do not believe that Christians have any monopoly of goodness. When I write of Christianity, I mean Christianity with a definite creed and militant organization, and not these good, kind people, good and kind, but not very fastidious about the exact use of words. Such good Christians can be almost as bitterly critical as I am of the continual pressure upon the faithful by that inner group of Italians in Rome, subsidized by the fascist government who pull the strings of church policy throughout the world, so as to do this or that tortuous or uncivilized thing, to cripple education, to persecute unorthodox ways of living. It is to the influence of the church that we must ascribe the foolish support by the British Foreign Office of Franco, that murderous little Christian gentleman, in his overthrow of the staggeringly liberal Renaissance of Spain. It is the Roman Catholic influence the British and French have to thank for the fantastic blundering that involved them in the defense of the impossible Polish state and in its unrighteous acquisitions. It affected British policy in respect to Austria and Czechoslovakia profoundly, and now it is doing its utmost to maintain and develop a political estrangement between Russia and the Western world by its prejudiced exacerbation of the idea that Russia is anti-God, while we Westerners are little children of the light, gallantly fighting on the side of the cross, omnipotence, greater Poland, national sovereignty, the small, uneconomic, prolific farmer and shopkeeper, and anything else you like to imagine constitutes Christendom. The Vatican strives perpetually to develop the present war into a religious war. It is trying to steal the war. By all the circumstances of its training, it is unteachable. It knows no better. It will go on until some economic revolution robs it of all its funds. Then, as a political influence, it may evaporate very rapidly. The Anglican Church and many other Protestant sects, the wealthy Baptists, for example, follow suit. It is not only in British affairs that this propaganda goes on. With the onset of war, France becomes militant and Catholic. It has suppressed the Communist Party as a gesture of resentment against Russia and a precaution against post-war collectivization. The Belgian characterist Raymakers is now presenting Hitler day after day as a pitiful weakling already disposed of and worthy of our sympathy, while Stalin is represented as a frightful giant with horns and a tail. Yet, both France and Britain are at peace with Russia and have every reason to come to a working understanding with that country. The attitude of Russia to the war has, on the whole, been cold, contemptuous, and quite reasonable. It is not as if these devious schemes can take us somewhere. It is not this restoration of the Holy Roman Empire. It is not that this restoration of the Holy Roman Empire is a possibility. You confront these Catholic politicians just as you confront the politicians of Westminster with these two cardinal facts, the abolition of distance and the change of scale. In vain. You cannot get any realization of the significance of these things into those idea-proofed skulls. They are deaf to it and blind to it. They cannot see that it makes any difference at all to their long-established mental habits. If their minds waver for a moment, they utter little magic prayers to exorcise the gleam. What they ask has mere size to do with the soul of man, mere speed, mere power. What can the young do better than subdue their natural urgency to live and do? What has mere life to do with the religious outlook? The war, these Vatican propagandists insist, is a crusade against modernism, against socialism and free thought. The restoration of priestly authority is its end. Our sons are fighting to enable the priest to thrust his pious uncleanliness once again between reader and book, child and knowledge, husband and wife, sons and lovers. While honest men are fighting now to put an end to military aggression, to redeem indeed that war to end all wars that was aborted to give us the League of Nations, these bigots are sedulously perverting the issue, trying to represent it as a religious war against Russia in particular and the modern spirit in general. The well-trained Muslim, the American fundamentalist, the Orthodox Jew, all the fixed cultures, produce similar, irrelevant and wasteful resistances, but the Catholic organization reaches further and is more persistent. It is frankly opposed to human effort and the idea of progress. It makes no pretense about it. Such cross-activities as these complicate, delay, and may even sabotage effectively every effort to solve the problem of a lucid collectivization of the world's affairs, but they do not alter the essential fact that it is only through a rationalization and coalescence of a constructive revolutionary movements everywhere and a liberal triumph over the dogmatism of the class war that we can hope to emerge from the present wreckage of our world. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Hour of the Time. That was Chapter 6 of H.G. Wells' The New World Order. I hope that you've been listening. I hope that you've been analyzing some of his thoughts, because some of them are very, very constructive, while others are perhaps very, very dangerous. Now, this book was written in 1940. We've had over half a century now to analyze these words and think about them and see where these ideas have continued, where they have faltered, and where they are going today. Does this have, because it was written so long ago, any impact upon our modern lives? Well, yes indeed, ladies and gentlemen. And if you haven't figured that out yet, don't bother tuning in to parts 3 and 4 of H.G. Wells' The New World Order. We will be continuing this next week, finishing this series up. I know we had discussed on the website about getting the Corporate Symbology 2 webpage up. We've had some problems with some of the equipment at our studios. We've been unable to use our scanner, and a lot of these scans remain unscanned at this point. So it looks like it may be another week or two before the Corporate Symbology Part 2 page comes online. You can go to our webpage, hourofthetime.com, and check out the products we have for sale, and more importantly, check out the information that we have available for you online for free. Now, if you get anything out of this broadcast, we would encourage you to donate to this cause. You can write to us directly at Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelt E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Well, I'd like to thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We're just going to conclude tonight's episode with a piece of music by the band called Cooper Hill. God bless each and every one of you.